So I'll be, the talk might have some provocative statements during the 30 or 40 minutes that I'll be speaking. And the idea is to get us warmed up for what is coming after. So just to group this guy, right, what I'm going to be saying, most of you already know. But the point is, again, just to basically try to see the picture in an overall way and discuss some of the approaches we have to actually implement Dyson's equations in the computer. So I'll be speaking a bit on the standard Cauchy approach, and you'll hear a lot more during the talks to, of this three-day workshop. Then I'll mention some things about the standard characteristic approach, and then at the end I'll say a few things about the conformal approach. So if you basically want to give your grad students a project in incorporating Einstein's equation in the computer, then you can just tell him, well, these are the steps you have to deal with. You just take the equations, and in this case we're even going to make it one because a pi is just awkward. Then you tell him, well, the only thing you have to do is just deal with a nonlinear partial differential equation system, which has 10 equations that a priori doesn't have a well-defined initial value problem, so you have to come up with it. And that has a lot to do with the different approaches to Einstein's equations. You have to face the singularities and how you treat them numerically, or where you actually can treat them numerically. As I said, you have to come up with the evolution equations, somehow choose correct coordinate conditions, somehow again choose correct initial and boundary data. That actually has two steps, and I'm going to say a bit on that. If you are going to consider non-vacuum spacetimes, you also have to deal with the fluids and all the SU that comes with it, shocks, and again, consider correct initial and boundary data. Given some limited computational resources, you have to somehow come out with algorithms that incorporate everything that you wanted to do, and this loop is basically being revised all the time because as computer becomes better, then you can do more, etc. So our task basically concentrates in this area and also in this area, and hopefully the stock market will take care of this thing, though it hasn't been doing a good job lately. Anyway, the first thing is how to treat singularities. So we know in our simulations, especially if you're dealing with compact objects, we'll have either singularities to begin with or they will form during the evolution. And they are certainly tricky to handle analytically. And just a huge understatement is they are a computational nightmare. So the question is what to do if you have them. So the idea is to excise them. So this is an idea that Bill Unruh proposed 15 years ago or so, which basically is human nature. If something bothers us, we just try to kill it. So that's what we're going to do with the singularity. If we have, say, a star that collapses, form a singularity here, and then it's just present in our space-time, what we're going to do is choose a foliation that basically penetrates the event horizon, and we'll just cut it short. We're not going to even try to deal with the space-time that is around the singularity. We're going to take it out of our computational domain. This, in principle, work if cosmic censorship is correct. That is, if there is a singularity that is always surrounded by an event horizon. So this is the way we deal with singularities, but we have to be careful with two issues. The first one, which is the one we always worried about, everyone worries about, is that the black hole you can only find a posteriori. You have to solve for the space-time and then reconstruct the event horizon because it's a global notion. So in practice, what we do is look for trap surface, outermost trap surface, that, again, under some assumptions, you know they are inside event horizon, and that basically gives you a marker of where to stop your foliation. The other one, which only recently have we started paying more attention to, is the fact that when you do this, you introduce another boundary, and the way to treat this inner boundary is a tricky one, and I'll say more things about it. So one has to be a lot more careful than we initially thought we should. If you wonder why excision works, well, there are basically two ways of seeing it. One is a physical way of seeing it. Basically, you say, well, if I have my grid this way at some certain time and I'm going to go at a later time, I'm wondering how to update this point that doesn't have points to the left. If it is moving at a speed that is faster than the velocity of light, then this guy here, its domain of dependence will be nice and have information everywhere in the past slice. Mathematically, you can think of it as actually as an inner boundary being an inflow boundary. All characteristics, if you look at the characteristics of this point, point towards it. Therefore, if you want to update the equations here, you only need information here. Nothing is needed on this side, and that's it. So the idea that the way to implement this is to say, at the inner boundary, we don't need the inner boundary conditions because its value, the value of the function there is going to be determined by the exterior of it, which is where we have correct data. We have to. So this is actually a lot simpler said than done, because one of the things you have to worry about is where the coordinates actually behave well. Coordinates in relativity can move at will, and they can move a lot faster than the speed of light, and in that case, this picture will break. The other thing is, even when you make sure that the coordinates are well behaved, it's not true that any surface inside the black hole will be in flow of this, where you'd be able to use the structure of the equations to update your inner boundary points. A very trivial example, just consider an x equal constant surface that is inside the black hole. And just take Schwarzschild in Paniagudson or Kerr-Schild coordinates, and you can prove in just a line, basically, that if this surface is at x greater than 2^3 to 3/2 m, it actually ceases to be space-like everywhere. And so this actually imposes a restriction on which kind of boundaries you can choose in your computational domain. And this is a point where we haven't been too careful in the past. So let me just jump into this Cauchy approach to Einstein's equation, the 3 plus 1's decomposition of Einstein's equation. Basically, you introduce a foliation of the spacetime by a sequence of space-like hypersurfaces. Coordinates at different slices are related by a shift vector and a lapse function that basically tells you what the difference between time measure in this in the normal direction and where this coordinate goes from one slice to the other one. The metric, the standard variables that you deal with are the 3 metric on this hypersurface and the extrinsic curvature, which basically measures how these 3 surfaces embedded in the 4-dimensional spacetime. And Einstein's equations can be written roughly in this way, where you have the evolution equation for the 3 metric, the evolution equation for the string metric, and the right-hand side you have a bunch of terms. These are evolution equations, which you can use to update the values of the function here onto the next hypersurface. And then you also have constraint equations that do not involve time derivatives, which basically are consistency conditions on your variables. So these are more or less the equations. These are the ADM, we call it ADM equations, although it's in a slight abuse of notation. But that's, for instance, the equations that John Baker said they were using in their code. Some observations of what happens when, what generically happens when you put these equations in the computer and try to see what happens. Well, what happens is you see instabilities all over the place. What you see is exponential solutions that are commonly found. Constraints, if you use this constraint that should be equal to 0, and by the way, I'm restricted to the vacuum case, you see them exponentially diverging. You also see that you can have equivalent formulations of Einstein's equations that are completely equivalent at the analytical level. When you put it in a computer, they behave quite differently. And I'd say a bit more about that, but let me just show you an example of, by Keeter et al., where he show Einstein's equations written in 2 different ways. And just by choosing some parameters that basically shouldn't, that do not change anything at the analytical level, at the numerical, you have evolutions that last for very short time or evolution that lasts for very, very long time. And I'm going to get back to this point in a second. However, even these equations, the ADM equations, and the very conveniently chosen coordinates, things look quite okay. And even, I'm going to get to this point also in a minute, some reformulations of the ADM equations or reformulations that are grown up from ADM equations work quite well in a number of cases if you do quite a careful job at the coordinate level. So there are a bunch of questions that have been lurking around in the last three, four years, basically trying to see how is that you can remove these problems and try to basically fulfill all the problems of numerical relativity. Some of them are, well, is there a way to eliminate or minimize this exponential growth that we see in the solutions? Are constraints, these constraint violations, to blame for all or most of the problems? Are equations conveniently written in the sense that can you write the equations in a different way that will improve the situation? In fact, we did have some, we do have some examples where this is indeed the case. Are problems, the problems that we see, arising due to simplistic type of boundary conditions? Well, actually, the answer is kind of all the above and then some. Some things that we haven't yet thought of. But we are there are things that we know how to cure or improve, and we're going that way. So let me just mention some of the partial answers that we've been obtained. So let me get back to the ADM equations and say that, well, if you use free evolution, that is where you use the constraints only to monitor the behavior of your solution, you see that they are typically unstable, except under very specialized coordinates. And also, what you see there, and generically, under generic coordinate conditions, you see that the system is only weakly hyperbolic. And I'm getting into this because I'm going to say something about this distinction. Basically, given an evolution system, or a system of evolution equations, you can divide them roughly by the property related to hyperbolicity and just determine where they are weakly, strongly, or symmetric hyperbolic. But basically, it's as following. Suppose you have a vector of unknowns that evolves under this kind of equation, and simply by analyzing the eigenvalues, roughly, of these matrices, you can determine where they are weakly, strongly, or symmetric hyperbolic. You may wonder, why do we care about that? Well, there is a lot of mathematical literature on the subject, and one of the things that you first see is that if you have a system that's weakly hyperbolic, it's unstable for generic lower order perturbations, basically for generic B, U, and C terms. You can have solutions that will blow up exponentially, and no matter how much resolution you add, the things are not going to improve. In fact, they're going to get worse. However, if you have strongly or symmetric hyperbolic system, what you find out is that given an initial value problem, the solution is going to be stable in the following sense. The solution at a later time is going to be bounded by its initial data and some constants and an exponential that where this A and this K do not depend on the initial data itself. So this doesn't buy you much in the sense that, well, you can still have exponential modes, but at least you know that some departures on the initial data will not screw this and, in fact, actually map out a convenient way to approach the stability problem of the equation at the implementation level, and that's going to be the subject of Manuel Tilio's talk on Wednesday. It also tells you a lot more. It tells you that, for instance, if you're dealing with strongly hyperbolic systems, there are, and you have now boundaries in your computational domain, the imposition of boundary conditions in a stable way is a very delicate enterprise, and some examples have recently been shown by Serbach and Scalabrese, where although you have a much nicer system in the sense of its properties, once you put boundaries into the game, you can get nasty behavior. And the question of dealing with boundaries is a very important one. We know that if the initial data satisfies the constraints, the equations are, the full Einstein's equations are going to be satisfied at a later time. If you don't have boundaries, or if you have boundaries and you only consider the solution at a point where its path domain of dependence doesn't touch the boundaries. But in reality, our game is more or less like this. You have the solution, you want the solution at this point, the boundaries are way too close, and you have a lot of interaction with the boundary. To the point that I would safely say that no matter what you do with initial data, if your boundary data is incorrect, it can make the initial data completely irrelevant. So it is indeed the case that boundary data is playing as big or even bigger role than the initial data you're considering.
No, they don't make it relevant.
Say again?
They don't
make it relevant. Well, I can put incorrect boundary data there that doesn't conform to the physical situation.
You're just saying that the fact, that you messed up the initial condition, but you don't want to start with violating the first.
Of course, no, of course. I mean,
so they're not irrelevant, are they?
irrelevant. Okay, in the point, the point of view I'm taking is there is a physical situation that you want to deal with. If you put the wrong boundary condition, you could have done a very good job at the initial data level, and you're still gonna screw. Okay, thank you. So, a lot of effort has been invested in the recent years in looking for a best formulation or a better behaved formulation of Einstein's equations. So one road has been to actually consider slight modifications of the ADM equations. So the most popular one is a family now, because there are several flavors of it, of the BSSN. This is the way they are called because of Baumgartner, Shapiro, Shibata, and Nakamura. That basically you use some of the constraints, because now if you remember the evolution equations, where evolution equations that determine how the G and K evolve in time, but you also have these constraints that were equal to zero. So you could, in principle, arbitrarily add it to the right-hand side of your equation and nothing would change. Well, depending on how you do that, you can either discard or make some offending term be less of a factor in your evolution equation. So that's exactly what BSSN does. And you get quite improved behavior. This is an example of by Alcubierre et al., where you can evolve for a very long time a perturbed black hole, where the ADM would have failed miserably right at very early times. So this is one road. And if you take it at face value, it's not clear. I mean, I already sold that maybe you want to look at some nice properties of the equations, but it's not clear at least level that's being used in most of cases where they are symmetric or strongly hyperbolic. Though they could be made symmetric hyperbolic, and this is a paper that appeared last year by Olivier Sarbach and Manuel Tilio, and there is another one that I'll comment in a minute. There is a second road, which is basically motivated what I said two transparencies ago, which is to obtain and deal with explicitly symmetric and strongly hyperbolic systems. And there are lots of them. I mean, I cannot comment on all of those. And if I start putting names, I'm going to miss someone out. So I'm basically make everyone angry by not putting anyone. But basically, what I'm going to say is most of these start by reducing the system to first order type. So you introduce extra variables that take second special derivatives out of the game, and you only deal with first order time, first order space derivative. And therefore, you have to deal with a lot more variables, two to three times as many variables. But this is not needed. There is a paper 2 years ago by Crash and Ortiz where they show how to basically analyze the hyperbolicity properties of a system, just keeping it in the second order in time, second order in space derivative kind of way. And a paper on the works basically does the same thing, but now only reducing to first order in time, still keeping second order in space, and showing how to prove the hyperbolicity properties of systems, and in particular also analyzing that the BSSN under correct or under some choice of coordinate conditions indeed is symmetric hyperbolic. Why is it important, or why is it useful to go to first order in time and space? Well, because once you have it this way, there is lots of mathematical or applied mathematical literature that tells you a great deal of how to choose your implementation in such a way that you can guarantee stability at the numerical level. And that, again, is going to be discussed by Manuel Tiglio on Wednesday. There are some other added bonus of this road, which is basically you can exploit now the expected growth of the solution just by looking at the scheme, at the system, at the analytical level, and you can try to take advantage of it to come up with better options. So one of them is to look at the constraint behavior. We said earlier that the constraints are growing exponentially, so there has been lots of activity to try to choose a formulation that will have the constraint behave the best. So one of them was to enlarge the system, now bring the constraint into the game and come up with evolution equations for them in such a way that we'll drive them back to the constraint surface, so that surface that satisfies the constraint, the constraints being equal to zero. There is another one by Lindblom and Schill last year, or the year before that, where they examined the constraint growth at the onset just by evaluating the different initial data, how to choose these three parameters that basically give you a huge family to deal with at the beginning, but by examining how much these constraints could grow you can reduce the possibilities and try to use one that will in principle have the minimal constraint growth. There is a recent paper by David Fiske that shows how to modify the equation such that if you now consider how the constraint would evolve, you actually would have them naturally go back to the constraint surface, but there are some technical details that are there that may make it problematic. There is another one also recently that shows you how to choose a parameter on the fly as the evolution is going on, so that you actually do not depart from the constraint surface but basically stays there, or even try to drive it back to the constraint surface. You also have to could use it to exploit in the sense of trying to achieve stability, and it's a very well defined way. That is, if you have a conserved quantity in your system and you can use that to guide a particular combination of variables that would actually preserve at the numerical level, and therefore at the onset you can guarantee there should be no exponential growth. And it's a paper that we put out also recently out. And then at boundaries, you can also, given a boundary, see which modes are propagating towards the boundary or from the boundary, and so therefore you can distinguish which information you can give at the boundary, which ones you cannot. And this is subject of Jeff Winkler's talk also on Wednesday.
I don't understand. When you force the constraint to propagate in a certain way, I mean, they already have one and only one way to propagate. And that's by the Bianchi identity, third Bianchi identity. So if you modify the third Bianchi identity,
No.
Stay near zero.
I mean, it depends how you do it. If you bring it to the constraints as part of your evolution equations, you could, in principle, do that. You just put a force in terms that will make it go back to the constraint surface. But what happens is that at the numerical level, so this is the example I show by Kidder et al. Given a single and it was, I think, was your family? No, it was the KST family of formulations, where you have three parameters that basically adjust how you put the constraints to the evolution equation. Just by changing these parameters, you have something that would be violated right away, or that would stay put for quite a while and then slowly start violating.
Yeah, so you need to change the equations of motion. You don't need to change the equations of the evolution of the constraint, because you can't do that.
Well,
no, you can't do that.
No. I agree. No, I totally agree with that. What I'm saying is, you change the equation of motion so that the induced evolution of the constraints now has this property that will be attracted to the constraint surface.
And at the same time, satisfies the Bianchi identity. Yeah.
It should. That's where there are technical difficulties in some of these in these alternatives.
Well, I think I know why there's technical difficulties. You're violating an identity. I mean, I know it's not an identity
at the numerical level, right?
But you have a small number, and you have a system of constraint propagation that's beyond the identity in hyperbolic form. Yes?
That's right.
That's right, and that's it.
That's it. So now what you're trying to play is to play with the numerical part to do the job for you. Because what it's doing at the numerical level, it's not satisfying the BI candidate, it just actually is going the other way around. So it has this little truncation error that is taking you off instead of either staying there or bringing you back.
I understand what you want to do, but the way you explain it is really kind of weird. The way you said it's taken liberty is wrong.
Okay. There is an alternative, though, that hasn't been exploited too much, which is to adopt a constraint evolution approach. So far, only the evolution equations have been iterated, but there is an alternative to use some of the constraint as part of your system to solve for the sum of the variables. So that is known as a constraint evolution strategy. So one question is, what do you solve for? You have lots of variables, and you have four equations, the three momentum and the Hamiltonian constraint. So one way is to use the Lignerovich-York approach to extract some preferred quantity to solve for, and you solve for exactly those. And some examples are already published, like or already out in GRQC. For instance, in axis symmetry, Choptek, Hirschman, Liebling, and Pretorius do exactly this, where they use the constraint to solve for some of the variables. Therefore, by definition, they have no constraint violating growth. They might have some evolution violation, and that's what they use to monitor the equations or the evolution. And there is some work in 3D done by Matt Anderson, Scott Holly, and Richard Master. And so this is just an evolution that we might see later in Franz Pretorius' talk of this work, where they solve for basically the scalar field coupled to gravity. They start with two poles and they just follow the simulation around. These two supercritical pulses collapse and form their individual black holes and then eventually merge into a single one. So this is another avenue that hasn't been much explored in the past, but it's showing quite nice results. So now let me switch gears and go into the characteristic formulation. And here, instead of choosing a foliation of space-like hypersurfaces, you choose a foliation of null hypersurfaces, in this way. You choose a coordinate along null rays. You choose two coordinates that basically label the null rays and say they are going out to infinity. And these different labels of the foliation, say it's given by you. You can write the metric in this form, this Bondi-Sachs form of metric, which looks very different, but then again, you're choosing a completely different foliation. And the equations look basically like this, where you have these three quantities that have no time derivatives, and then you have this quantity that is in front of, say, the two-sphere part of the line element that obeys a first-order in time, first-order in space wave equation. If you, for a moment, set r equals 0 in this element, so you take a given work tube at r equals 0, then this metric basically induces this particular metric in this work tube, and you can recognize from here what u and this combination mean by just making an analogy with the 3 plus 1 formulation. This is like the square of the lapse, and it's like the shift. So at a given work tube, you're free to choose those. But interestingly enough, you're not free to choose them over the whole spacetime. And that just shows you there's quite a bit of rigidity in the coordinates that you're allowed to choose in this formulation. One interesting ingredient of it is that the spacetime can be compactified without any problem. You go all the way to null infinity. The outer boundary is a null boundary, it's a causal boundary. There is no boundary conditions that you have to put there. And your domain of dependence is just this. So only one boundary you have to deal with this, which is this inner boundary, where you can't have inconsistencies. But what happens in practice is that if you generate an inconsistency there, it propagates out infinity and you never see it. So there is no backfeeding effect that you have in the 3 plus 1 decomposition when you do the boundary conditions in the wrong way. The structure of equations, as it says, you have two first order equations in time and four constraints that actually are, in a way, ODEs iterated along the radial lines. The coordinates are quite more restricted, free only at a given work tube, and that's because these coordinates have to define null surfaces. The well-posed properties of this is only known for the case where the inner boundary is null. And that's actually quite intuitive. If you have two null surfaces, there is no interaction between them. There is only a regularity condition needed at the intersection. So it's actually straightforward to derive that. The main difficulty that prevents a broader use of this formulation is caustic or crossover. So because you're now tying your coordinate system to what null rays would do, if they cross, your coordinate system becomes singular, and the formulation breaks down there. There are some ways out. One way is to treat them analytically head-on. If you know the structure of the caustic, you can incorporate that into your implementation that was proposed by Frederick and Stewart. The other one is to use multiple patches, and in each one you use a different formulation and you appropriately match at the given boundary. The characteristic codes basically are all finished and in place. There are 3D versions and 2D versions that are out there trying to do something useful. So let me just give you one example, which is, as I said, this, because you have to satisfy this no caustic condition, otherwise you cannot apply the formulation in a straightforward way. One interesting problem you could think of dealing with is a problem where you have a neutron star in front of a black hole. And if this neutron star is initially close enough, the caustics will not form before infinity, and therefore you can actually use this characteristic formulation to treat it. So there is this is the only example where we're not going to be talking about the vacuum case. So this, you'll have to incorporate the fluid equations, which if you write in a conservation form, basically look like just advection equations with some fluxes equal to some sources. And so just an example of what you would have in this case, if you have the star at, say, 9m apart from the black hole, where the black hole will sit in here, and you put this in a trajectory that goes in this particular angle, say, this is what you see. So let me start this one. So that's a cut of the density in the direction of the movement, while if you look at the perpendicular direction, then you basically see the star slowly going towards the black hole. So this is a code that is there. It's finished in a way. You can use it to calculate your waveforms. Unfortunately, it takes about a month to produce a single template, and that's kind of useless.
I'm not sure what I'm looking at here.
So here is a plot. It's just a contour of the density. So it's just yeah, yeah. So I put it twice so that you can see it more clearly. So as far as producing reliable waveforms that can be used in data analysis, this is not good because it takes too long to produce a solution. So we're working on trying to improve this in many different fronts. You can also choose a rod by simply choosing this U vector, the shift at a given word tube. You can actually choose coordinates that will be co-rotating. So this is an example of the star initially, and in the standard coordinates where you choose this shift to zero, you see this density at a later time moving to the right. If you choose co-rotating coordinates, then it basically stays there. So it's also nice as far as numerical techniques to improve resolution is concerned. So just an outlook of this particular formulation. In its simplest form, it's suited for perturbation of single black hole spacetime because single black holes have been evolved there since 98 without problems. It's very neat to study asymptotic structure of spacetime. It can take you all the way to infinity, and there you can actually use it to probe the spacetime in general. The other interesting application of it is the matching to a Cauchy formulation to remove hard boundaries. So you could think that you have a Cauchy formulation in here, characteristic formulation out there, and by appropriately matching these two, you can have a clean problem in some way. But this is subject of Jeff Winnicker's talk. There are open questions still. The stability in the rigorous sense for a time-like null boundary problem still hasn't been addressed. There is strong evidence, experimental evidence, that this should be doable, but nothing has been done yet in that regard. And there is one could think of translating a step involving assessing stability of the initial boundary value problem of the Cauchy approach to do this, but hasn't been done yet.
Are you aware of this new book called Evolution Problem in General Relativity?
No.
By Serge U. Feinerman?
No. But not for the GR case. They do it for...
No, it's for GR. The whole book is on GR.
But don't they do it for the scalar field in this particular formulation? That's Christian Dewey.
I'm not talking about Christian Dewey Feinerman. I'm talking about Feinerman.
Okay.
He has a new book called The Evolution Problem in General Relativity. And a lot of his ideas are based on pictures that are not too different from this. And it's hard going, but there's good ideas in it.
So when this came out?
It's Rydell, I think, or
okay.
One of those publishers that still publishes beautiful books.
Thank you.
And it's a lot better. I mean, I don't know if one or two people who can read this to do it in the environment, and it's still the mirrors. On the other hand, Leinemann's book is a much more polished thing. And I don't say it tells you how to solve a numerical relativity problem. What I say is that it takes the point of view that Jeffrey's point of view in mind, that you have some social problem, and then the outer evolution of it is like this, and you put this family stuff in here, and then you just try to prove the existence of infinity. It's like proving the existence of an entire space. That's much clearer approach. Huh? Nicole, sorry.
Okay. Thank you. I'll look at it. So let me just mention the last approach, which is this one introduced by Friedrichs in the 80s, which is it's known as the conformal approach to Einstein's equation, where you basically start by saying, I'm not going to solve for the space I'm interested in, I'm going to solve for the larger space that contains it, and only recover it a posteriori. So the picture would be something like this. This is, say, for the Kruskal form of Schwarzschild, the Schwarzschild spacetime, you embedded into a larger space-time, a metric you solve for the conformally related metric, and then a posteriori, once you recover the space-time, recover the physical one. The equations are naturally more involved, and among the things you have to deal with is evolution equations for the conformal Bayer tensor. You don't, if you now say you come out with the Cauchy or the 3 plus 1 approach of it, you see that you have five gauge functions, so you have the flaps and the shift just as before, but now you have an extra one, which is basically related to given two conformal, if you have a conformal metric for this spacetime, and now you're hit it by a positive function that will also give you the same kind of, the same spacetime. So this, you have this extra freedom that you have to somehow fix. The outer boundary, and this is one of the most interesting ingredients of this approach, is hidden by future null infinity. So you could have boundary conditions there, as long as the air is stable, they would not influence the physics inside of it. And this is a big problem, as you'll hear in Jeff's talk. The conformal, if you now have to worry about the initial data, which basically reduces solving the constraint equations, the conformal constraint equations are considerably more complicated, and only in 1D have they been tackled. However, it was shown by Frederick Hunter and Kuschel that if you restrict your initial data only to the physical spacetime, the constraints that you have to solve there look very much the same as the 3 plus 1 constraints or the standard ones. And from there on, you could, in principle, tailor things outside in a way that maybe they violate the constraints, but then, as we said, because of this, exterior spacetime should be hidden from the physical spacetime, you could, in principle, do it correctly. That is a delicate process numerically, but your Fraunhofer has been working quite extensively on this, apparently is the case, though there is some numerical diffusion into the physical spacetime. In principle, as you take the limit to delta going to zero, this shouldn't be the case, but it points to some problem. So just an example, this is some work by Sasha Husa, Marsha Weaver, and Peter Huebner. They basically recover the stability of Minkowski by just choosing some initial data in your spacetime, say this is the conformal spacetime, you know, solve for the whole spacetime and you send a bunch of observers, you see that all the null rays basically meet at a single point, which is the regular I plus of Minkowski. The advantages, there is no need, as I said, for physically relevant boundary conditions. Any stable boundary condition should be fine. It's certainly flexible to consider our approaches. The fact that the Cauchy approach has been presented doesn't mean that it's the only way to go with it. You can also think of introducing a characteristic approach within the conformal spacetime, and you would get the same benefits that you'd get in the standard spacetime. And again, if one of the things you're interested in is the asymptotic structure of the spacetime, is ideally suited for it. These advantages, I'm going to put as a question mark because it's actually, this formulation has received a lot less attention, so it's not clear where it's a disadvantage. It's just the fact that less people have been working on it. The initial data issue is a major one. Why would you expect a good evolution if you're violating constraints outside of the physical spacetime? Because after all, you are evolving the equations there, and it might go to hell just because you do not put in correct initial data. The coordinate conditions are not clear. On top of all the problems you have in the standard approach, you have somehow to fix this extra freedom in a convenient way. But there, it also shares, and additionally shares all the problems of the standard Cauchy approach, which is, if you have a free evolution, how you can, is there a way to play around with the constraints in such a way that you have a system that at the numerical level would be better behaved? That again is not, it's an area of investigation. So let me just skip this and go to the final comments. So I would say, just as in GR and numerical relativity, it is one size doesn't fit all. Depending on the problem, you might go with either one of these formulations. If I have to say some few words on each one, I would say that the 3 plus 1, the standard one, is general, has a very flexible gauge. You have to deal with the time-like outer boundary, but it's certainly the most popular. The consistent initial, in order to come up with consistent initial data, it requires solving elliptic equations, but those are solved basically now every day without problems. And considering constraint evolution is feasible, and that is a way probably to invest more time. That should be more looked at. The characteristic approach is a lot more restrictive. It has a very rigid gauge. But it has a null outer boundary, and therefore you don't have to worry about that. When it can be applied, assuming you don't have cosics or crossover, it works scarily well. And I say scarily well in the sense that although there are no theorems backing up the stability of this approach, right, wherever it has been applied, it has worked without problems. It can be used to study most asymptotic questions, and the definition of consistent initial data is trivial. Because it's in an outgoing, or it's in a characteristic, you can put basically anything you want. It's unconstrained. But the problem is how you give initial data that is physically relevant, and that's a problem shared by all approaches. And the conformal approach is, again, very general. It has a very flexible gauge. The outer boundary is not a problem because it's hidden by null infinity. And it can accommodate for either a 3 plus 1 or a characteristic or any general approach that you can think of. The initial data is considerably more involved. The same thing for the gauge or coordinate conditions, and can be used to study asymptotic questions. The consistent initial data is similar to the 3 plus 1. Again, you have to solve elliptic equations, those can be solved, but you have to be careful what happens outside of your physical spacetime. And again, the constrained evolution equations are feasible if you're using a 3 plus 1 sort of approach. I would say very open questions in all of these: how to give physically relevant initial data for all three of them, and boundary data, physically relevant boundary data for the first one. And if you are now going to consider giving boundary data, especially, well, in these two cases, in the 3 plus 1 case, either here or here, the main problem is how to give it in a way that is stable and is physically relevant. I think that's it. Yeah, thank you.
Does anybody else have a question before I turn Jimmy loose on Luis? You have no friends, at least.
No, it's just complementary, and it's PLE, also PLE. But this approach, the last one of the previous, there's an analogous approach by Madame Choquet and I, and it doesn't use any extra conformal anything. What Friedrich does is he assumes the Ricci tensor is zero from the beginning, and then he uses the Weyl tensor and all of its spatial properties to write down some symmetric system. All right, now what we do is different. We don't use the Weyl tensor, we use the full Riemann tensor so that we can also couple to matter, and we've written a paper how you do that. But in ours, what he does is very illogical, and it's bound to run into trouble. Because in our problem, the initial data, since it's a higher order equation, it comes from the full Bianchi identity. And that's a symmetric system. And then there are equations connecting the curvature to the connection, which are symmetric systems. And then finally, the evolution of the spatial method. And in our formulation, they're only the last initial. And the initial data it's the same initial value problem as before, which is to solve the constraints, and then you put what k dot is, those are the initial conditions. And there's no problem with it. And when you do those initial conditions, you get a unique solution. The solution of the Einstein equation. Now, it's not reasonable, no matter what the equations look like and all the conformal factors look like, it's very illogical to assume that the Ricci tensor is zero before you start, because that's the problem. So, there's something peculiar about and sort of, inbred. There's something inbred about using Bianchi identities, assuming the Ricci tensor is zero, and developing equations from that beginning. And what all I'm going to point out here is you don't need to do that, and you get a standard initial value problem. On the other hand, you're not looking for the conformal things that readers do. It's a standard question problem. But it's adapted to the picture, time-like boundary, and then wings, space-like, wings. And it must be said that in all the analysis of asymptopia in these mixed Cauchy characteristic problems, the Bianchi identity, the full Bianchi identities are the key to the whole thing. So we built a system of equations with no one has evolved. It doesn't have any free parameters at all, which evolves by way of the full Bianchi identity. It connects all the way down. And just an editorial remark, I do not believe for 1 second the correct method is the key change in parameters. In theory of using the Einstein method, this is what we do now, I hope we can see, but in the end, it cannot possibly be correct. I mean, it's just ignorance. Once we know how to do the boundary value, every time you introduce all these things, you introduce more artificial constraints. Nobody really systematically knows that these constraints remain true. We have all these other constraints. Negative first order. So, it should be minimal. It should be some connection. And in the end, that's what happens.
Noted.
Ugly.
Any other quick questions? All right, let's thank Luis again. And,